Rachmaninoff's cello sonata, ending that recital given by one of today's most enduring musical duos, the cellist Yo-Yo Ma and the pianist Catherine Stott, who've been playing together as often as their schedules will permit for the past 25 years. Well, that was the chamber prom given last Monday and broadcast live here on Radio 3. We're going to be back at Cadogan Hall this Monday for the last of the proms season, and we go out in style. Christian Tetzlaff and Lars Vogt in recital together. That's live here on Radio 3 at 1 o'clock on Monday. But you don't have to go and wait that long to hear more live music from the proms, or indeed from Cadogan Hall, because it's just after 3 o'clock, and we're going to cross live now to Cadogan Hall for a proms Saturday matinee. It's introduced by Christopher Cook.
A very warm welcome to Cadogan Hall and to this last prom Saturday matinee of 2011, and a programme of music that possibly hopes to justify the ways of God to man, or even the works of man to God. The BBC Singers and the Britain Symphonia, conducted by David Hill, are going to perform music by Sir John Taverner, with the cellist Natalie Klein as the soloist in Populae Meus, and Sofia Gubadelina's The Canticle of the Sun. But first, music by Sir Michael Tippett, a pair of early works written during the Second World War when Tippett was director of music at Morley College in South London, where he made it a home for musicians who'd fled from Central Europe. One of Tippett's duties was to conduct the college choir, always, it seems, a pleasurable duty, as it gave Tippett, the composer, a chance to conduct his own music. In 1942, he wrote a pair of madrigals for the choir, the first of which is a setting of Gerard Manley Hopkins' sonnet, The Wind Hover, in which a falcon watched whirling on the wing provokes in the poet thoughts of Christ. After that madrigal, we have a motet. It's Plebs Angelica, composed in 1943 and commissioned for Canterbury Cathedral. Tippett may have been an agnostic, but in Plebs Angelica, he certainly responds faithfully to the medieval Latin hymn in honour of the angelic host, praising St. Michael, St. Gabriel, and all the phalanx and squadrons of the Prince Archangels in a properly cathedral manner, with the choir divided between the Dean side, Decani, and the precentors, Cantoris. But it's the falcon that takes flight first, and then the angels. The BBC Singers are now in place on the platform here at Cadogan Hall behind me, so will you please welcome David Hill to conduct the BBC Singers and perform Michael Tippett's The Wind Hover and Plebs Angelica.
I caught this morning, oh, in sin, a morning to dream.
Angels and archangels take wing in Michael Tippett's setting of the medieval Latin text Plebs Angelica from the Tropa of the Abbey of St. Martial in Limoges. And before that, David Hill conducted the BBC Singers in Michael Tippett's setting of the Windhover by Gerard Manley Hopkins, a poem that the poet himself amongst his very finest. The best of Sir John Taverner's music has always circled the mystery of man's spiritual struggles. Populae Meus, which has been given its first British performance this afternoon, strives to banish the temptations of the material world, with the solo cello, in Taverner's own words, as the all-compassionate one, battling it out with the timpani, who represent man in his vain and pointless rejection of God. Accompanying this mighty struggle is the string orchestra, a concerned onlooker rather than a participant in the fight itself. Populae Meus, Taverner has said, is a meditation on the Judaic and Christian text, O my people, what have I done to thee that thou shouldst testify against me? It ponders the wholesale rejection of God by modern man, with the composer arguing that however much man rejects God, he cannot yet escape him. Indeed, he is condemned to the supernatural by his own God-made nature. The cello may have the last word at the end of Populae Meus, having been steadfast in its profession of faith throughout the piece, but the timpani certainly don't go gentle into the night. Taverner, who has embraced the spiritual traditions of both Eastern and Western cultures, explains his ending with an apparent paradox. Even in the winning, the darkness loses, and even in losing, the light wins. Passion, resurrection, and redemption, or in Hindu terms, Atma, the absolute, alone is real. Maya, the relative, is merely illusion. Well, the members of the Britain Symphony, led this afternoon by Miranda Dale, are now in position here on the platform at Cadogan Hall, and it's time for them to tune. The solo cello part in this piece is played this afternoon by the former BBC New Generation artist, Natalie Klein. Jeremy Corns is the timpanist. And so now David Hill, please welcome him back to the platform, conducts the strings of the Britain Symphonia in this first British performance of Sir John Taverner's Populae Meus. Natalie Klein was the cello soloist in that performance of Sir John Taverner's Populae Meus, a lament at man's turning away from God. The timpanist was Jeremy Corns, and the strings of the Britten Sinfonia were conducted by David Hill. And as you could hear from the warmth of the applause here at Cadogan Hall, Sir John Taverner is with us in the audience. Next, more music for strings from a master of the form. The Britten Sinfonia is going to play Michael Tippett's Little Music for String Orchestra. It was given its first performance in the Wigmore Hall in November 1946 by the Jakes String Orchestra as part of its 10th birthday celebrations. As its modest title suggests, the Little Music for String Orchestra sits between a pair of much more ambitious compositions for strings, which did much to make Tippett's reputation as a composer. The Concerto for Double String Orchestra, written in the 2 years immediately before the Second World War, and the Fantasia Concertante on a theme of Corelli, which dates from 1953. But this little music shares much with its larger companions. There's a fascination with the Baroque there in the flourishes with which the piece opens, and in the second and final movement fugues. And the third of the fourth movements is christened Air, which surely hints at Tippett's favourite English composer, Henry Purcell. And sure enough, the movement is built upon a properly Purcellian ground base. Will you now welcome back to the platform David Hill to conduct the Britten Sinfonia in Michael Tippett's Little Music for String Orchestra.
Thank you.
little by name perhaps, but large in its ambitions. Michael Tippett's Little Music for String Orchestra, David Hill conducted the strings of the Britten Symphonia. In a moment, we'll be hearing more from the Symphonia, or at least three of its members, as well as Natalie Klein and the BBC Singers, for a performance of the Canticle of the Sun by Sofia Gubadulina. But this is a piece that requires a pretty dramatic rearrangement of the furniture here at Cadogan Hall. So while things go bump to the right and bump to the left behind me, I'm very delighted to welcome David Butcher, the Chief Executive of the Britten Symphonia. David, welcome. You've just come back with the Symphonia from, I think, Mexico.
We've had quite a journey, actually. Often the summer for us can be relatively quiet. The busy time is really October to June. And summer, we have sporadic festivals and things. Of course, we love playing at the proms. But this year, we had a busy time. We were with Rufus Wainwright at the Opera House for a while. Then we headed off to Mexico for about 5 or 6 days. Then there was a short gap, and we then went to further south, to South America, to Brazil, Argentina, and Uruguay. And I was thinking, actually, I was listening to the Tippett, looking at some of our lovely players, that there's a definite bronze tan thing going on there. Which has a lot to do with our running team, which runs along Ipanema and Copacabana Beach.
David, you don't have to make us feel too jealous. No. We have enjoyed the rain here too, I think, this summer. What were you doing in Mexico? You weren't only playing, I think you were working with young musicians in Mexico too.
We did, and also when we're in Brazil and Argentina as well. And I think it's terribly important. Sometimes with touring, you parachute into a venue, give a concert, and then you move on for the next time. I think the great thing about these two tours were that they were spaced out. So number one, the players had time. They weren't dashing around over the place. But in Mexico, we worked with the Anglo-Mexican Foundation. And as well as giving concerts, we were giving master classes. Some of our players were going to local youth orchestras, sitting at the back of the seconds, coaching them. And I think it makes it more exciting for everybody. I think as an orchestra going into a country, you get to know that country well. There's a bad analogy I have of when I travel abroad, I like to go on the public transport to see what the real place is like. And I think as an orchestra, there's a similarity in if you just give a concert, you're not really connecting with the audience and the community. So our lot, fortunately, many of them teachers, actually love coaching and giving masterclasses.
The emergence, if not to say the eruption, of the Simon Bolivar Orchestra suggests there's something quite remarkable going on with young musicians in South America, in Latin America. Is that your experience? Was that what all of you found in the Symphonia?
It is. I mean, I talked to some of the players, particularly in Mexico and in Buenos Aires, that the quality of players was staggering for such young ages. We had 11 and 12-year-olds playing Mozart concertos. And I gather from the schools and the conservatoires that wasn't happening 10 years ago. So even when you haven't got a kind of system in place that they have in Venezuela, the waves are kind of reaching new places and new ways of teaching and learning are coming forward.
Is there any obvious way of explaining this? I mean, you know, one would like to think that this is a kind of rolling wave that goes around the world and reaches other places and comes up, but it is quite astonishing what appears to be happening there at the moment.
Yes, it is. And I think the other thing worth saying is that I think there, in terms of classical music, there's no class barriers. There's no feeling that it's not for us, it's for them, or you have to be particularly posh, or you have to kind of have, you know, thousands of pounds to actually kind of learn a violin. I think it's encouraged now in all the schools. It's hit the schools as well as reaching the conservatoires. So there's a lot of exciting things going on in South America, and a lot I think that this country can learn from.
Nearer home, the Symphonia become, I think, the orchestra in residence in Brighton at the Dome. Tell me a bit about that. What's that going to mean for you all?
Well, it's starting next season, which we're very excited about. We've played regularly in Brighton for a while, and it's a lovely compliment to us because we play regularly in Norwich and in Cambridge. In London, I'm delighted to say, at the Wigmore Hall in South Bank. And we've been playing regularly in Brighton, and they've basically kind of got to know us and have asked us to go in on a more residency basis. So next season, we're doing about 5 or 6 concerts, some big scale things. So we've got, what have we got? We've got Mark Elder conducting L'Enfance du Christ with our own choir, orchestra. But we've also got smaller scale chamber music concerts taking place. And crucially now, we're working on a program of community education, learning work, everything from pre-concert talks, masterclasses, things I was talking about that we've been doing in South America. And that is terribly important because it means that you actually kind of get rooted in what's going on in the community.
David Butcher, thank you very much for being with us this afternoon.
Thank you.
Well, the Cadogan Hall platform is just about transformed now, with the string desks removed, and in their place a positive battery, if not a regiment, of percussion for the final work in this prom Saturday matinee. It's by one of the most admired amongst contemporary composers, a woman who is celebrating her 80th birthday this year, Sofia Gubaidulina. She was born in the former Soviet Republic of Tatar in 1931 to a Muslim father and a mother who was a member of the Russian Orthodox Church. And she writes her music from within these two distinct traditions. Rather like Haydn, perhaps, in 18th century Esterhazy, she worked for many years in isolation and without much recognition, forcing her to become highly original and to chart her own course on the compositional high seas. She was, however, a pupil of Shostakovich when she went to Moscow in her late teens, and he, quickly spotting her maverick tendencies, encouraged her, in a wonderful phrase, to continue along your mistaken path. Well, this mistaken path has become ever more remarkable in a series of compositions that, like her contemporaries Arvo Pärt and John Taverner, are grounded in her own deeply held religious beliefs. Works like the piece that we're about to hear, The Canticle of the Sun, a setting of a famous poem in praise of the natural world by St. Francis of Assisi. The chorus, percussion and solo cello. Natalie Klein will be back to take the solo part when we hear the piece in a minute or so. Sofia Gubaidulina's The Canticle of the Sun strives to create a unique world, and it's a work where silent contemplation matters quite as much as musical sound. The original text from which the piece takes its title was written by St. Francis of Assisi while the saint was recovering from an illness in 1224. In the hymn, St. Francis praises God and his teeming creation. We are all part of one another, brother fire, sister water, sister moon and brother sun and all that is. It's a hymn of thanks to God for the infinite variety of the natural world and the place of humankind within it. Well, St. Francis' words in Italian are sung by the choir, and so in one sense, the Canticle of the Sun is a substantial choral setting of a sacred text. But at its heart is also the incredibly demanding and virtuosic part for the solo cello, and that effectively makes it a kind of concerto for that instrument, with some extraordinary coloristic effects in the solo writing. They include tapping on the strings with a drumstick, and if that wasn't enough, towards the end of the piece, Gubaidulina requires her soloist to play fexatone, tam-tam, and bass drum as well. Here's multi-skilling in music of the highest order. And as well as the percussion played by the cellist, two other percussionists play a huge array of instruments, which have now been set up behind me on the Cadogan platform. Timps, marimbas, glockenspiels, tam-tams, bell plates, that slabs of metal hung from frames, even a selection of wine glasses just behind me to be played with wet fingers. And added to all of that was a part for the celesta too. Well, this afternoon, the percussionists from the Britain Sinfonia are Owen Gunnell and Jeremy Corns, and playing the celesta is Hugh Watkins. Behind them, in two rows, the BBC singers. And so, to perform Sofia Gubaidulina's The Canticle of the Sun, now please will you welcome David Hill and the cellist Natalie Klein.
Et nobilo et serre. Thank you.
The Canticle of the Sun by Sofia Gubaidulina, a composer contentedly out of step with the modern world, as one music critic observed. Natalie Klein was the cello soloist, practicing her skills with the percussion desk. David Hill conducted the BBC singers, and three instrumentalists from the Britain Sinfonia, percussionists Owen Gunnell, Jeremy Cones, and the celeste player Hugh Watkins. The soloists for the BBC singers were Elizabeth Poole, Rebecca Lodge, Christopher Bowen, and Charles Gibbs. And that's the last of these four proms Saturday matinees here at Cadogan Hall. Of course, the BBC proms continue for another 7 days in that other place up the road from here, the Royal Albert Hall. But for now, it's time for the rest of this Radio 3 this afternoon with Ian Skelly.
Chris, thank you very much indeed. That was Christopher Cook at Cadogan Hall this afternoon. We're back, as he says, at the BBC Proms tonight, live at the Royal Albert Hall for music by Rachmaninoff this evening, his Rhapsody on a Theme of Paganini, Kodály and Elgar, and our own Michael Barclay, if I can call him that, the first London performance of his organ concerto. David Good will be the organist, Marc-André Amelin the pianist, and Jack Van Steen conducting the BBC National Orchestra of Wales, all live at the Proms tonight at 7 o'clock here on BBC Radio 3. But now it's just after 25 to 5 and it's time to turn our attention to the world of jazz. Time for Jazz Library with Alan Shipton.
This week, Jazz Library explores the jazz work of the pianist and composer whose most famous piece is this theme. Mission Impossible. Composer is Lalo Schifrin, one of the most famous of all Argentinian musicians, and briefly in the 1960s, one of the leading lights in jazz, not only as a pianist, but also as a composer and arranger. His background was classical, and his father played in the Buenos Aires Symphony Orchestra. But along with the classical piano lessons came a love of jazz, learnt from records by Dizzy Gillespie and Charlie Parker, and from meetings of the Hot Club of Argentina. When I met Lalo Schifrin on one of his regular visits to London, he began by talking about the ideal opportunity to put those musical passions together.
I got a scholarship at the Paris Conservatory for composition. And during the day, I was studying at the conservatory, and at night, I was playing. I became, in France, a professional musician, and we had a very good rhythm section. Pierre Michelot on bass and Jean-Louis Vial in drums. I was going to say à la batterie.
Yes.
But I was not sleeping too much, but I was very young. I was, you know, during the night playing jazz and then take a shower, sleep for 2 hours, study a little bit and go to the conservatory during the day. And I studied with Olivier Messiaen, who opened my ears and my perception to many aspects of music that are interesting.
Now, I mean, he was presumably teaching composition.
I didn't study piano at the conservatory. My scholarship was only for composition. When they were offering through the French embassy these scholarships, they were for cello, violin, piano, and composition, and I applied for composition only.
And it must have been a very exciting time with Messiaen, really, at the height of his powers at that stage.
Yes, unfortunately, he didn't like me. He didn't like me the moment he found out that I was playing jazz. I don't know, he didn't understand jazz. He thought that jazz, the rhythm section, was static. And he didn't understand the element of swing. I wish I could have had more communication with him. I was very, very young. I was really in my late teens and early 20s. And he was such an authority already also. And he was a mystic. You know, he was very Catholic. As a matter of fact, I remember that some of my fellow jazz musicians thought I was crazy because the only day I could sleep, which was Sunday, I was going to Mass to listen to Messiaen playing in the Church of La Trinité. He was improvising in the organ. Amazing things. The relationship ended very bad, although he gave me good grades because I studied and I applied myself and I understood everything he was saying. Nevertheless, the moment he found out that I was a jazz musician, he never talked to me directly. He sent messages through my fellow classmates.
Extremely scarce example of Lalo Schifrin and the rhythm section he mentioned of Pierre Michelot and Jean-Louis Vial, joined there by percussionist Jacques Del Rio, playing Sidney Bechet's Les Oignons in 1955. It's one of a handful of discs that Lalo made during his student years. Sadly, his regular gigs with saxophonist Bobby Jasper and guitarist Sacha Distel were never recorded. But that comes from a French Vogue CD called Two Argentinians in Paris, with the balance of tracks by Astor Piazzolla. It's currently out from BMG France and also available for download. Playing jazz and studying composition in Paris were two of three elements of Lalo Schifrin's life there. He also became an avid moviegoer, and seeing the same film sometimes as many as a dozen times to study the score fueled his ambitions to be a movie composer. But first, he returned to Argentina as a jazz pianist and took over the radio big band. But in 1956, his life changed forever when Dizzy Gillespie's State Department band came to town.
When Dizzy came, I felt such an affinity for, and the music they were playing, it was exactly the way I felt the music should be done. So I went to all the concerts. That week I didn't sleep. Quincy Jones was fourth trumpet in that band. Phil Woods was on that band. It was an all-star band. Benny Golson was one of the tenor saxophones. Benny Powell.
Terrific band. And I think Carl Warwick too, Bama Warwick.
Carl Warwick was playing first trumpet. And Dizzy was on in front playing the soloist. I mean, and Charlie Persip on drums. It was a fantastic band. And then one night we played for him after his concert because they were booked for 1 week and they were sold out. That was the first time an American band came to Argentina. When Dizzy heard my band and he heard me playing the piano, he says, "Did you write these charts?" "Yes." He said, "Well, would you like to come to the United States?" And here I am. I mean, the rest is history.
When you actually arrived in New York, Lalo, after that fairy tale invitation from Dizzy, what happened? How did you actually end up playing in the band?
It took some time to get a green card, and by the time I arrived, Junior Mans was playing in the band and he was leaving, so it was some time between when I occupied the chair of pianist. But meanwhile, he told me, "Why don't you write something?" So I went and I read the sketches of the Gillespiana Suite. So I went to his house and I played it for him, And he says, how would you like to orchestrate this? And I said, well, I hear a jazz quintet in front, your quintet, and a brass band, no saxophones in the band. It's replaced the five saxophones by four French horns and one tuba. And then the rest will be four trombones and four trumpets. And immediately he called Norman Granz, who still was the head of Verve Records. He called him and says, how long is it going to take you to orchestrate it? I said, well, about 3 weeks. So he said, okay, 1 month from now, set two sessions. We are going to do it in two sessions. This is fantastic. I want to do it. And that was it. We did it. We'll be right back.
Toccata, the final movement of Lalo Schifrin's suite Gillespiana, which he wrote in the autumn of 1960 on his arrival in New York. And that was recorded on November the 16th that year by Dizzy Gillespie's Big Band. Full personnel is on the Jazz Library website. The album, Gillespiana, was issued by Verve, and although it's a little hard to find now, there are copies still around. The alto saxophonist was Leo Wright, and that roaring trombone was the work of the normally somewhat more restrained Irby Green. And as well as Dizzy's own trumpeting, I'd also draw attention to the section lead work of Ernie Royal. The piano interludes were by today's Jazz Library subject, Lalo Schifrin.
It was an amazing band, one of the best bands that you could put together in New York. And New York was the capital, the Mecca.
It must have felt like that. And to have that band playing your music must have been a great thrill, too.
Yeah,
once you got over the...
I was very nervous. In a moment like that, you overcome your nervousness because you want the things to happen and the music dictates. I conducted and played and the music dictates everything. And there was such a good feeling. Everybody was so excited with, and what is very rewarding to me is to see that something I wrote so many years ago is still alive and became a classic.
Sticking with that period, there was a concert at Carnegie Hall shortly after the recordings with Norman Granz that we were talking about. Was it a similar moment of nervousness for you for this music to be going in front of a concert audience for the first time?
No. Already, by this time, I was becoming not blasé, but a little bit more confident, let me put it this way. We did tours within the United States to try it out. As a matter of fact, it's like a off-Broadway show. So we did a tour in New England. We played Hartford, Connecticut, and some other towns with the band before we went to the Carnegie Hall. So also, you notice that I'd written with the same kind of orchestration other pieces. The concert lasted 3 hours.
Yes, I mean, one of my favourites is that marvellous rearrangement of Night in Tunisia. I think that's a fantastic...
Yeah, but they didn't put the last movement. It was in three movements.
There's only two on the record.
I call it Tunisian Fantasy, and it put the only two. The ending is missing. But, you know, this is the kind of things that happen, yeah?